Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today, our special guest is Rick Chargood. Rick is an executive vice president at Carrington Mortgage Holdings, LLC. Rick is one of the nation's most frequently quoted sources on foreclosure, mortgage, and real estate trends, and has appeared on NBC Nightly News, CNN, CBS, NBC, I guess just about every possible outlet there is. Rick is also a member of the board of directors of REOMAC and the president of the Technology Council of Southern California. Rick, welcome back.
Nice to speak with you, Bruce.
You've changed hats since we've last spoken, and you've begun work with Carrington. And I'm just curious, what does an executive vice president with Carrington do with himself all day?
There's plenty to do here, Bruce. It's a 2,000-plus person company that in a lot of ways is still in growth mode. The oldest company here that's part of the family really was only founded in 2003. So there's no shortage of things to do. But I mean, candidly, I'm doing a lot of the same sort of work I used to do when I was over at Realty Track, trying to make the Carrington brand name a little bit better known in the various markets that we serve.
And that kind of brings up the question about what it is that you guys do and who you would be putting yourself in front of that would be different than Realty Track.
Yeah, it's a great question. Very, very different company. The company was started actually as a hedge fund back in 2003 by a gentleman named Bruce Rose, who came out of Solomon Smith Barney, and started investing in mortgage-backed securities.
Somehow I knew that was going to be the background.
And a lot of the mortgage-backed securities that the company invested in were built based on subprime loans.
Right.
When the market started to go sideways, Bruce decided that we really needed to do something to be able to take over servicing of the loans that were in those pools in order to manage their disposition. So we bought the mortgage servicing business from New Century's bankruptcy in 2007. And since then, sort of more by accident than design, started creating ancillary business units to support the investment and servicing operation. So we created Carrington Property Services to manage the assets. We created White Van Real Estate Services to do property preservation field services. We have a real estate brokerage called Atlantic and Pacific Real Estate that manages the sales transactions of properties. And we created a mortgage lending business, Carrington Home Loans, that actually originates mortgages. We also have a title and escrow company. So we're really involved in virtually every aspect of the single-family real estate business, ranging from investing in pools of loans all the way through writing a title on an individual property.
Okay. That's a company, private or public?
It's a privately held company.
Okay. Purchasing loans in bulk, is that still a mainstay?
Yeah, in fact, finally, the market is starting to open up a little bit.
Okay, because I knew there was a dry spell, but I didn't really know how extensive that was.
Well, you and I have talked about this over the years, and we both anticipated that we'd see larger pools of loans being sold off earlier in this downturn than we actually have. So we've purchased two pools of loans from large lenders, somewhere in the $150 to $250 million range in the last few months. These are all non-performing loans that we then try and modify using our servicing organization. And we have a pretty good track record at loan modifications. And so that is an absolute important part of our business.
What would be the concentration of the location of those loans, East Coast or West Coast?
Not surprisingly, we're still looking at the hardest hit states, and we'll probably skew more toward the Southwest and the Southeast.
Okay.
Occasionally we'll see some business in Texas or Illinois or somewhere like that, but mostly Southwest, Southeast.
Okay. Now, foreclosure laws are different everywhere. So Does that really make a challenge trying to get ownership of the property, or you know, just all knowing all those different things are different, and I'm sure you have to be an expert in each of those. But in California, those rules change, it seems like, every quarter. So is that going on everywhere?
Unfortunately, yes. I was talking to somebody in our servicing business today, and I didn't realize this, but there are 45 separate state programs that are just oriented toward working with distressed borrowers that as a servicer you have to be aware of and potentially plugged into in order to help those borrowers avail themselves of state funds to get out of trouble. So it's crazy. Florida is still a huge mess. It's a judicial foreclosure state that takes over 750 days to do a foreclosure. New York still has a distinction of having the longest foreclosure cycle. It's 1,100 days plus from the time the borrower gets that initial notice of default through the date that the sheriff's sale takes place. So it does vary wildly for obvious reasons. If you're a company like ours, you try and avoid states like Florida and New York and New Jersey, which are just backlogged and very, very difficult to get through the process. And you know, the reality is we're trying to modify more loans than we foreclose on.
Mm-hmm.
But even doing that becomes problematic in those states. You know, forget about the law changes and the regulatory changes, but borrowers really don't have a lot of motivation to modify their loans in those states.
Well, they've kind of enjoyed
rent free for a couple of years.
Exactly. They haven't paid anything for a while.
Yep.
They do get used to that.
Yes, it's probably easy to get used to.
when you're buying pools, is this a competitive bid situation or a relationship-oriented offer?
Typically, there are competitive bidders involved, and very often when we don't secure a pool, it's because we feel like somebody's overvalued it and is overbidding for those assets. The number of bidders is typically fairly limited. So
yeah,
the lenders are one of the aspects that is relationship oriented is the more intelligent lenders will take a look at what's going to happen to their borrowers if they release these assets to an investor. And to a certain extent, to the extent possible, they would much prefer to work with a company like ours who will try and take good care of their borrowers and come up with better resolutions. There are other investors I categorize as sort of the churn and burn guys,
mm-hmm.
Who really are trying to rapidly move into foreclosure, evict the borrowers, and flip the properties for some profit short term, and that not only is not good for the borrowers, but we don't think it's good for the local housing markets because you're selling these properties still at a pretty significant discount at a time when the market really doesn't need much more of that.
Well, you know, I wish they were selling at a significant discount.
Well, you're in an unusual place along those lines.
There's a lot of new money that's shown up that seems bent on paying full price and still writing a check for it with all cash. I'm sure you're familiar with some of that.
Well, you know, Bruce, we raised $450 million with our partner Oaktree to go out and buy vacant REO properties and convert them into rentals. And I've often thought of you as I'm having conversations with people about this program because you know, you really sort of set the bar for how to do this in a local market. And so to a certain extent, yeah, there's institutional money coming into the market to compete with individual investors like yourself. The reality is, we're walking away from most opportunities to purchase right now because the numbers have gotten silly. We see people coming in and paying full value or overvalue on a property just so they can get into this part of the market, and we think that's not a terribly intelligent strategy and certainly one that's more focused on short-term than it is on long-term opportunities.
Well, you know, it seems to be they have simultaneously has almost had the same dream and that this is the best avenue for wealth is to own rental real estate in Riverside.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, it's not just Riverside, but everybody saw you get rich so fast, I guess they figured that was the right place to go.
I think there's nothing else to do with their money. I wonder if that changes, if their attention will be withdrawn from residential real estate just as fast as it showed up.
We're a little concerned about the nature of the investors getting involved for the reason you're suggesting. We're also concerned that we're seeing some people again and already trying to use leverage to buy, which suggests they might be undercapitalized. And you know, as a landlord, that you need some underlying capital to be able to support the infrastructure and to properly maintain the properties. So we're a little concerned about undercapitalized companies coming in. We've actually heard investors say things like, well, we'll buy the properties now and figure out how to manage them later, which is scary.
Yeah, and the cities are really willing to find them on the way to their education, I can tell you that.
They are, and that's I believe is going to be a lesson that some of these folks learn the hard way. But I think your one of your initial comments was spot on. There is still significant interest in finding ways to invest in the residential real estate market. And there are precious few ways to do that from an institutional perspective. So the opportunity to participate this way in a way that also we believe fills a market need, because we do believe we're going to see significantly more rental activity over the next few years. It can be a win-win if it's done properly. And I tend to believe there's enough inventory for everybody. That institutional investment is only going to take up a certain percentage of the market, and individual investors like yourself and home buyers will still be able to find the inventory they're looking for once the spigots are opened up a little bit by the people holding the assets.
You know, with all the infrastructure of REO agents all over the place, why would a lender choose to sell in bulk if they could, you know, just list them with people that used to have, you know, 500 listings that now have 50? Why do they choose the bulk route? I'm sure it's in their best interest, but I was just trying to figure out why it is.
No, it's a fair question, and that's the question that the realtors raise regularly. If we were really dealing with limited inventory, and if all the inventory was saleable that way, I don't think we'd be having this conversation.
Okay.
There are a couple sort of macro trends that suggest this is an interesting way to go. We believe that we're going to see home ownership rates continue to plummet for the next 2 or 3 years. We would not be surprised if they drop as low as perhaps even 60% nationally.
I think it's a mathematical certainty. I mean, you've got 8% of the people not making their payments for a long time.
So if that's the case, and I've seen some projections even lower than that, you're going to have more inventory than you have buyers.
Absolutely.
There's also a situation where 96% of rental units nationally are occupied. So rental rates are escalating, and there's simply not a lot of available places for people to live. And our extensive research suggests that most people still prefer to live indoors. So that suggests that renting out some of these properties would seem to make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a backlog of seriously delinquent property that has not yet gone through foreclosure and has been delayed by things like the robo-signing scandal and the Attorney General settlement. And now, ironically, the Attorney General settlement's requirements for principal balance write-downs have slowed things down yet again. But when all that inventory hits, and the regulators start pushing the banks to get some of that inventory off their books, they're going to have to do something with this inventory. Most conservative number I've seen recently is there's still something like 600,000 REO assets out there, excuse me, that simply are off the market, not being marketed. And if they were all on the market, they would have a terrible effect on home prices. So this is maintaining inventory levels and supply and demand control, and trying to maximize value. But the other thing I should point out is most investors I've talked to are willing to pay somewhere between 80 to 90 cents on the BPO for these assets, because they're looking at the return on both rental income over a certain period of time and then banking on home price appreciation at the end. So they really don't need to buy these things at typical bulk sale prices.
Right. Is there a date in mind or a date mandatory when they have to exit the properties?
No, unlike the regulations that the lender has that say they have to typically get rid of a property within 3 years after taking it back, I think we're, at least in our case, we're looking at probably a minimum hold time of about 3 years. And you know, as long as 7 years, depending on given markets.
But it's got some flexibility.
It has to, and our investors have got to have that sort of a long term view and B, flexibility and approach. And then you know, if the program works like we think it will, we're considering creating a REIT that makes it then an ongoing investment opportunity. And you basically buy and sell properties out of the REIT as market conditions dictate.
Well, if your projection is correct that the ownership declines for the next 3 years, then there's no way you're going to have price increases in any of those years.
No, we're really looking. Well, in some markets, this is going to be a recovery that's extraordinarily localized, and I think we're seeing evidence of that even today.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that we're probably looking at a bumpy ride along the bottom of the market for the next several years on a national basis until we work through this glut of distressed inventory and until we get unemployment rates down to where people start buying. I know you're a statistical geek like I am.
Yes.
And one of the things I've noticed is most of the relationships that most of the data points that would have causality or correlation have fallen apart over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
When did we ever see a period in time when prices fell, interest rates fell, and sales volume fell? Never happened. The one that hasn't broken, interestingly enough, is the relationship between employment rates and home sales. And historically, there seems to be an inflection point somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 6.5% unemployment,
mm-hmm.
where home sales either spike up or spike down, depending on which way the unemployment's going.
Okay.
The most optimistic projection I've seen is we won't get below 7% unemployment for another 2 to 3 years.
You know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, we've got, for instance, in Riverside, something like 45% of people upside down, so the mm-hmm. former or the current owners are incapable of buying anything because of debt levels.
Yes.
And then 60% of sales in Riverside are either short sales or REOs. So 60% of the people that have unowned their real estate are incapable of buying as well. So, you know, you start putting together the numbers of unemployment and all of that. It's sort of, okay, well, who is expected to buy all of this inventory? It isn't going to be the owner-occupant in the next 2 or 3 years because they're going to be credit incapable.
We're flying in an ensemble from Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
and they're coming in with Swiss francs and will buy Riverside entirely.
Can I have an option first?
No, you're right. And a lot. And that's one of the reasons why we think a lot of this inventory is going to be purchased by investors, whether individual investors, small groups, or institutions.
Yeah, I don't think there's a choice.
I don't think there is either. And I don't, you know, in the short run, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
It's better than having vacant.
Well, it is. And I've used that argument quite regularly when people start talking about how bad renters are in the neighborhood. And I tend to think renters are a much better option than a vacant house that you know, becomes a crack lab.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an unfair thing to say about a neighbor who happens to be renting instead of buying in general, but again, a much better solution in a market that doesn't need any more vacant homes.
I think the finger pointing is to the investor. I mean, they're probably looking at the investor as unwilling to maintain the property at a level that's acceptable, even though the renter might want it to be. I mean, we're in kind of a group in Riverside, you know, we're pretty well liked by the city, so we have meetings, and you know, we've made some headway in how they view investors' participation in owning something. But not all investors are created equal, and so they're pretty cautious about thinking, okay, you know, another 10% of Riverside's going to go the rental route,
and you know what? Historically, you can't blame them.
No, that's true.
There have been a lot of abuses over the years. I think there is so much scrutiny on what's going on in the real estate market right now. And there is so much local enforcement of new regulations that some of that's going to be cooked out. But the other point I'd make is, you know, don't discount motivated self-interest. If we're an investor coming in to buy a property, rent it out for a number of years, and then try and sell it at a profit, don't you think we're going to try and maintain the property at a level where we're going to be able to maximize the profit at the end of that process?
Yeah, and also keep somebody decent in there in the process, too.
Absolutely. So, again, that's one of the concerns we have about seeing people already using leverage or looking for financing to buy these properties, because we're not sure they're going to have the capital that it takes to maintain these things adequately, and that could be a problem.
You know, when you buy a bulk package of loans, and it's interesting how the rules must have changed during the process of you owning, several thousands of these loans, and all of a sudden, you know, murders. We didn't know what those four letters meant, and all of a sudden, everyone in the country knew within 90 days what it meant. But that must have had a pretty profound effect on the cost level in dealing with a bulk of loans that now you have to look at and go, okay, do we have problems with this?
We have been either extraordinarily lucky or extraordinarily good at our diligence, and made some decisions several years ago basically not to be a MERS shop at a time when everybody was running that way.
Mm-hmm.
And have kind of applied that principle to loan purchasing as well. So we've been known over the years as a difficult investor because we reject a lot of loans that other investors are willing to buy for any number of reasons. And so I can't say the portfolios that we've purchased have been error-free and pristine, but they've probably been better than what's out there on average, and we've frankly been able to avoid a lot of those problems.
You know, if I was an occupant owner and I found out that your group bought my loan, I'd probably get a smile on my face, because to me, you would have more options than the original lender would have. Your cost basis would obviously be less.
We really do. And I want to make sure we're distinguishing that there's two separate initiatives we're talking about here.
Okay.
When we buy a pool of non-performing loans,
yes,
it is not with the intent of creating rental properties from that pool.
Correct.
What we're looking for there are REO properties that are already vacant, because we think that has the best impact on the market, and we think as the highest long-term return opportunity for our investors. So, but getting back specifically to your question, when we purchase a pool of non-performing loans, typically those loans are priced at more of a bulk rate, which means the discount could be anywhere from 40% to 60%. Of the unpaid principal balance,
which would make it market value in Riverside.
Which would make it what you're shooting for is slightly better than market value.
Okay.
And what you do then is you go try and work with the individual borrowers to modify their loans. And you're right; it's a lot easier for somebody like us, who's purchased a loan at a discount, to pass along a discount to that borrower.
We've only got about a minute left in this segment. So what's the most common outcome? If I'm the owner occupant, I'm going to get a loan mod with terms changed, or loan mod with principal reduction, or opportunity to do a short sale?
You'll almost always get an opportunity to modify your loan. We modified over 60% of the loans that we've had in our portfolio. And typically, the monthly payment is dropped by over 20%.
Principal reduction?
In some cases, if we see a loan that has a good opportunity to continue to perform, we will consider principal reduction as well, yes.
Okay. And short sale becoming pretty common?
Short sale is always our preference prior to a foreclosure. We think it's better for everybody involved. The ironic part of today's market is sometimes the hardest person to convince to do a short sale is the borrower.
Okay. Well, Rick, we've got to end this segment. This has been Rick Sharga with Carrington Mortgage Holdings, LLC. Is there a website you'd like to direct anybody to?
If you're interested in the company, it's CarringtonHC.com, CarringtonHC.com. That's the corporate thing.
All right, Rick. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.